This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with me, Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, of course, as always, is also Sharmila Gunnison. And our special guest today is also the voice of God for Buy the Book,
wow.
Arvind Yuvaraj.
You didn't expect us to give you that
No, not that kind of an intro.
Our personal Morgan Freeman is how we think of this.
Pressure.
Yes.
Hello.
Arvind is, of course, the guy who says, Buy the Book.
Buy the Book.
Yes. There it is.
Yeah.
It's amazing. There we go.
Buy the book.
Thank you for great. Oh, God. We've unleashed a monster now.
So Arvind is in the studio with us today because we are doing our latest installment of our book club today with a book that Arvind actually introduced to us. And do you want to do the title?
Yeah, so this is actually a book that was done on the way to The Last Jedi. So it's called Leia, Princess of Alderaan. I wish I was here to talk about some other book. Like part of me wishes that I was here to talk about The Hummingbird of Kathmandu or something.
There's no such book. Is that like a book I've
It's one of those deep books where someone gets attacked and has to find themselves and stuff. But no, I'm here to talk about Star Wars.
I think she gets attacked and she has to find herself.
That's what I was going to say.
True.
It has that vibe.
Nice story. I feel better now.
Governor Tarkin, I should have expected to find you holding Vader's leash.
I recognized your foul stench when I was brought on board.
So as the title kind of gives away, it is the story of Leia, particularly teenage Leia, right? Mm-hmm, as she's coming of age, and she has to kind of go through these rituals to ensure that she can, in fact, someday be the ruler of Alderaan, which is the planet she's from. And then it kind of goes from there.
Yeah. Spoiler, there's no Alderaan for the rule in the future. But it kind of... So I like that this book sort of shows you why Alderaan was so special to her, which the movies don't do. The movies kind of just brush it off as the planet that blows
up. Because it starts with, the very first Star Wars movie starts with Alderaan being blown up. Mm-hmm. So yes, it really does kind of bridge that gap for you. And you really get to know Alderaan as a planet, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, and throughout the book, you get this feeling of the more they get into what Alderaan is, you kind of feel worse for it. Because you keep feeling worse and worse because you fall in love with the planet, but then you're like, oh my God, I know what's going to happen to this planet in the future.
Since you are reluctant to provide us with the location of the rebel base, I have chosen to test this station's destructive power on your home planet of Alderaan.
No, Alderaan is peaceful. We have no weapons. You can't
You will
possibly...
prefer another target, a military target? Then name the system. I grow tired of asking this, so it'll be the last time. Where is the rebel base?
Dantooine. They're on Dantooine.
There. You see, Lord Vader, she can be reasonable. Continue with the operation. You may fire when ready.
What?
This book does that in a couple of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, as you mentioned, it is supposed to accompany the moment that we reach The Last Jedi. It's supposed to kind of all head in that direction. And you're also introduced to Amelin Holdo. You're also introduced to, you know, some people.
Saw Gerrera?
Saw Gerrera, yes. Mr. Old Terrorist in the corner. Mm-hmm. And with all these people, you know where their ends are. You know, in many cases, if you've watched the movies, if you're a Star Wars fan, then you're familiar with their stories and the paths that it takes. And so in some cases, that's more heartbreaking than others, I found.
Yeah. Mm. Is this your guys' first Star Wars book?
Ever, no. Yeah.
Ever?
Yeah. I've read other Star Wars books before.
Which ones?
I do not now recall. It was like a big old Star Wars book with a black cover and a Darth Vader helmet on the front. But it was sort of a kind of a retelling of it. It was part of the Star Wars canon, but I don't recall exactly what it was called. In that, I had the same experience of being able to have a Star Wars movie playing in my head while reading the book, which is a very nice way to go about it because you already know roughly what things look like. And in some cases, like with Leia, you know how things are going to be maybe 50 years, 100 years, however long these people live into the future. And so there is that sense of, oh, wow, this is all building up towards something.
So I've like actively avoided Star Wars books because of that, because Star Wars is, it's mostly sights and sounds. Like it's made up of all these like signatures, beeps and bloops and, you know, that every zongs and, you know, there's every single thing in the Star Wars universe has a sound effect to it, right? And then it has its own music, and John Williams' score sort of like sweeps everything and it underscores everything. So I've kind of avoided Star Wars books because I felt like it would be like reading the script and just seeing it on text, and it wouldn't have that kind of, it wouldn't have the sights or the sounds. Surprisingly, when I was reading this book, I found myself imagining the score in certain scenes. Like there's a scene where she discovers that she's force sensitive, and I love that scene. And they never actually use the words
force. They don't
force.
Actually say it. Yeah.
But they sort of allude to the fact that she is feeling, and you know, the force is sort of connected with her. And then I get John Williams' score in my head. And so I read the book and the text to his music, which makes it all the better. And I didn't know that was going to happen. I thought reading like a Star Wars book was going to be not as good as watching the movies.
I think in many ways, actually, the pre-existing experience that the movies have baked into our brains really helps in building that atmosphere when R2-D2 shows up. And she describes how he's talking in beeps. You know exactly what he's doing because you've heard him do it in the movies.
But she never says R2-D2.
She doesn't. But you also know who it is, right?
Yeah.
And it's I think it's those kinds of things that are very cool and why again, this was my first Star Wars book experience, and it's why I enjoyed it because it sort of extends the universe, but in a way that fits in really well and also builds on what you already know from the movies, which I would have thought would have been not as effective, but it works very well.
It does.
I think it works particularly well in, and we're going to talk, I think, about the genre trappings of it, because it's not just Star Wars and therefore sci-fi, but it's also YA, right? Which has its very specific cadences and very specific emotional points that it feels it needs to hit. But that sequence where she finds out, and it happens twice in the book, where she finds out, or she feels the force, where everything just sharpens around her, where she feels somehow at one with the space. It's beautiful simply because of the YA thing, where you are able to imagine that you are in fact Leia. And so there is a beauty to that and a lived-in quality to the force that you don't get when you're watching a Jedi just like choke slam someone against the wall or wave a hand and go, these are not the droids. You know, so it's different when it's through the body of somebody who's inexperienced and doesn't really know what's happening. And it was written beautifully. I agree. When I first recognized what was happening, I was like, Leia, it's the force!
Yeah. I think similarly, for me, the moment that really jumped out and got me really excited was when she makes a trip to Naboo. And in a way, it happens in this sort of like, you have this aha moment because she meets the current queen of Naboo. And when they describe her, you realize they're also describing what Amidala would have looked like. And the book doesn't say anything about Amidala actually being Leia's mother, of course. But there are all of these things and all of these characters who are speaking around them and people's reactions and just your pre-existing knowledge. When it all comes together and in your brain, you go, oh my God, Leia's going back to the planet where her mother was from and she doesn't realize that. It's so exciting.
There's a scene where they say that she has to wear like headgear to fit in it's customary in this place where she has to wear certain kind of headgear. And you're like, oh my God, she's wearing that same piece of headgear. So those things, but they never hit you over the head with it. Like the movies do. The movies will you know, hit you over the head with cameos and references and they'll go like, oh, I know Obi-Wan or whatever. And then the theme plays used to it. But the book never does that.
I think that's perhaps something that's peculiar to literature, right? You can lay in the thing without it having to, as you said, be in your face. Whereas in film, how do you do that? You have to either put it there or not at all, right?
Mm-hmm. Also, one thing that this book manages to do is it manages to imbue a sense of dignity to the Clone Wars that I did not think would ever happen. You know, because I mean, not to start the section of the show where we start dissing Star Wars, which is not my intention, but not my favorite version, not my favorite telling of the Star Wars story, the Clone Wars. But in this book, because of where it's set in time, it references it as, I guess, a point of recent history that everybody goes, well, we don't want that to happen again. Mm-hmm. Or you are... a war hero of the Clone Wars, and you come back with your own set of stories and your own set of why you never want this to happen again. And in that sense, it gave you an idea of the scale and gravitas of the situation and of its impact on the galaxy without necessarily having to say, okay, well, okay, here's the deal. Here's what happened, and going through that.
Yeah. Did you guys know that this was a YA novel? It's not a YA novel, but it has YA tropes, right? Did you guys know that before reading it, or did it like hit you halfway through?
I know Claudia Gray is a YA novelist, so that was a giveaway. Also, it was marketed quite heavily as the YA interpretation of Princess Leia. Mm-hmm. So yes, I already knew going in that it was YA.
So I didn't know. I didn't even think about it until like halfway through, and then she meets Keir, or however you say it.
Keir Domadi.
Keir Domadi. And there's a scene where they explicitly say like, oh, she would lean on his chest and hear his strong heartbeat, and yes. He was like whatever. And I'm like, wait a minute. Oh.
Where am I? What is happening?
What book is this?
So like, this was something Lynn and I were actually going to ask you because... you don't strike me as the kind who, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't strike me as the kind who would have naturally gravitated to that particular kind of YA, the one that's largely aimed at teenage girls, you know, and usually the world building and all exists, but that is a very strong component of it. So this would have been something that you're fairly unfamiliar with and how you felt about it.
So wait, is The Hunger Games like that kind of a YA novel?
Hunger Games does it a little bit, but Claudia Gray definitely does it more than someone like a Suzanne Collins would.
Okay. So in that case, then this is my first. Okay. But it didn't feel like it. So it didn't feel like a YA novel at all, except for those parts with Keir Domadi. Other than that, there are no YA tropes. Or maybe I don't know the YA tropes, so I think it's new or it's new to me. Mm. But this happens to me with movies as well. Like I'll watch a movie like 27 Dresses, and then someone will tell me that like it was, you know, quote unquote marketed for someone else. And then I'll be like, oh. Okay, but it was fun.
My God, you're the blank slate that everyone aspires to market to.
Yeah. Like, I think when I saw 27 Dresses for the first time, I didn't know that there was a specific audience for that. I went
it's
like...
A chick flick, you mean?
Yeah, chick flick. So I'd be like, yeah, I know what's this. Like, anytime it's on, it's fun.
I'm feeling a new level of fascination. We are going to, however, be talking and delving into a little bit more of the tropes that Arvin may or may not have noticed
have
in the
noticed,
book.
Yeah.
And just to reiterate, we are talking today about Leia, Princess of Alderaan, written by Claudia Gray. If you have actually read this and would like to weigh in, or if you've read any Star Wars books, let us know what you thought of them. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can write us at our brand new email address, buythebook@bfm.my. Just drop us a letter. We love reading them. And we'll be back to continue this conversation after this. You're listening to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Listening to Buy the Book with Lynn, Sharmila, and Arvin. It is our book club episode, as we do one a month, basically. And Arvin has brought to us this gift of Claudia Gray, Leia, Princess of Alderaan, which I think, not a spoiler to say that we all enjoyed.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Very much so.
Thoroughly enjoyed.
And also not a book I would have picked up on my own. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Shout out to Big Bad Wolf, because otherwise I wouldn't have picked up this book. Because normally they're way too expensive, these like Star Wars books. So I wouldn't know, because I was, like I said, I wasn't someone who would pick up these books normally. But because it was on sale, I'm like, okay, a lot of people have said a lot of good things about these books. I'll just pick one up. And now when the sale comes back this year, I'm definitely going to pick up the others.
Interestingly, Big Bad Wolf will also be one of those areas where it wouldn't have been shelved under something like YA. And thereby meaning that perhaps someone like you wouldn't have picked it up in the first place.
True. But then again, if you made like a MCU YA novel, I'd still pick that up. Because it had like...
You are a rare soul then.
Because, yeah, and also because it has like, you know, like either Black Widow or Princess Leia or Luke Skywalker, whoever it is, it has like people that I love. So I just pick them up. I wouldn't care if it was YA or not.
That point about YA is a holdover from our conversation just a little bit before the break, right? Where we were talking about the fact that, okay, so this story tells the tale of Leia kind of finding her way into the rebellion. So we haven't said that. It's her sort of trying to assess what her role could be. It's also an understanding of Alderaan, the planet that, as we established, disappears right at the start of Star Wars, or is vaporized, rather. Yeah. So with that, though, I mean, with YA entering the picture, I think what we're talking about in terms of the tropes, aside from the fact that there is a love interest and we need to take several makeout breaks, you know, that happen throughout the book, there's also, I think, the whole finding yourself thing that is done in a very specific way when it comes to young adult fiction, because the adults are always telling you, don't do this, don't do that.
Yes.
You're always caught between a very teenage thing where you're trying to establish your own points of rebellion, but at the same time, there is a safe space to come back to and grow from that. And so I think that is actually a pattern that we see recurring, gosh, I don't know, several times throughout the book where she continuously pushes the boundaries further, but always has a safe haven to come back to. And did you find that pattern of something that you enjoyed, or after a while did you find it starting to fall into a bit of a predictable kind of routine?
It almost did. Like, it almost did towards one of the later chapters, but then it never went into, like, you know, this is going on for way too long. Like, just before it got to that point, I think stuff escalated. Like, she found, you know, the other planets and the hideouts, and she would figure stuff out with her parents and all that. So it progressed. I think the pacing in this book was almost perfect. Like, if this was made into, like, a movie, not a movie, maybe like a series on, like, Disney Plus, not Netflix, but Disney Plus. it would have been good. Like, the pacing, if it followed this book, it would have been perfect beat for beat.
I don't know if I completely agree. I definitely got to a point about three quarters through the book where I started wondering, what's the actual story? Like, what is the overall story here? Like, what's actually happening? Where's the climax and where's it going? Like, what is the thing that we're dealing with? Because it seemed to me like There's the sort of this underground secret rebellion that's brewing. Mm. There's Leia's own, essentially it's a coming of age story. She's sort of in training to become queen. And she has all of these tasks that she has to undertake. But it just seems to swing from her doing that with her peers, her friends, and then her conflict with her parents, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the larger story just seemed to be the background with nothing much actually happening.
I get where you're coming from, but because I think that, weirdly, I think the title of the book saved it for me because it's about Leia. So once I accepted that this is a story about how she became, Princess Leia and then General Leia, once I knew or could kind of square away in my head that this is a story of how she became who she was, then I was okay with the fact that it was swinging back and forth. Because I agree that on the one hand, there's this very classic fairy tale thing of, I'm a princess, I'm going to become a queen, am I worthy? So that's one level of it. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, there's all the stuff that we saw in the early days of Star Wars with the, well, Palpatine's gone crazy.
Yeah.
You know, there's like Moff Tarkin, Grand Moff Tarkin, like going on and on. What do we do? What do we do? So there was that. I get that it's a big tonal shift that happens every time. But like I said, it was just like, okay, this is about Leia. I'm fine with that.
Mm. I also love that they touch on that stuff, like Palpatine and Grand Moff Tarkin and stuff. It's about, they've never really shown us the government that is the Empire in any of the movies. It's always like this, the evil dictatorship, and they're always shooting at people. You never actually understand why people fall under this government. Like, everybody should be, you know, in the rebellion. But here you see them, like, you know, shake hands with them. They have, like, parties, and, you know, like, Grand Moff is, like, attending other dinner functions and having dinner with the people who would be the rebellion. So it makes a lot of sense why, like, half the galaxy would be on the side of the Empire while the other, you know, like, small pockets would sort of rebel against them. Yeah. And I like that, because the movies don't have, either they don't have time to touch on that, or they feel the audience wouldn't know what to do with that information. But it's nice that this book sort of digs into that a bit, and then it shows how Leia sees all that, how she sees Grand Moff, how there are a couple of other cameos. I think, like, they never say Krennic, but Krennic shows up at one part. They sort of describe him meeting with someone about, like, Death Star parts, you know, like buying, you know, crystals or something like that. And, you know, like, you're like, oh, it's this guy. So all those bits and pieces are really nice. I don't know if the other books are as deep or as cameo heavy as this one, but if they were, then I'm definitely picking them up.
I think it's actually major props to, you know, Claudia Gray, and I'm not sure how much involvement there was from Lucasfilm/Disney in the writing of the book, but YA, you know, the young adult genre is often viewed not quite favorably by quote-unquote adult novels. But for a book that is YA, to be able to kind of really build that background of the universe, to draw upon and to really build in your mind a system, a government, how these different planets functioned, even little societies like the Chalhadans, the sort of aquatic society that Leia makes friends with, you know, they were only there for a couple of pages, but they were so distinct, like so well developed. And I thought that for a, again, I don't want to say for a YA book, but really a lot of people don't think that YA has the capacity to build this kind of world. And this is a great example of the fact that it absolutely can.
I think it's not just world building. I think there's also the fact that there is this assumption that young people are politically simplistic, or that, and that therefore fiction for young people will also be the same. That it's like, oh yes, there is an evil chairman. Let's all, you know, join rebellions and have secret meetings, and just someday we'll overthrow him. Don't ask me how, it'll happen. But with this, actually, the way that corruption was endemic, and the very particular the very particular forms that it took, right? Like the fact that you have sessions of Senate where Leia is there trying to make real change happen, and instead finding her decisions being co-opted for, like, you know, the book equivalent of fracking. It's cool. That kind of stuff, I think, really really showed in ways big and small how corruption is an issue, how this political system is rotten, and how on a day-to-day basis it's so boring and grinding, and this is actually what corruption looks like, right? Yeah. As opposed to just like execute them all, you know, it isn't like that. And so that I enjoyed deeply.
I love that they stayed away from Vader, because they always use him as a crutch, like the movie, like Star Wars.
I kept wondering if he was going to show up, and I was actually pleasantly surprised that he didn't.
Yeah, because all the movies do that. They use him as a crutch. Like, if they don't know where the story needs to go, they're like, throw Vader in there.
The breathing.
Now's the time. Now's the time, yeah. I'm so glad that they stayed away, because they could have easily put him in there somewhere and they could have connected her with him. But they opted to, Claudia opted to not have him in any of the chapters, which is nice. And also, like what you said before, I love that Amidala played a small role, like a significant role, but not as obviously as the movies would have done it.
So what are we excited then for other books in this series? And who would we be most excited for? Because with Leia, it's an interesting one, because she's so central, you know, she's so central to everything. And she's been this like iconic character for different reasons, right? From Gold Bikini to General. Like, it's quite a journey for somebody, for a single actress playing a single character to go through. So we have all that weight of history with Leia, with Han, with Luke, which is what the movies are also playing on. Who else are we excited to read about? Because I'm definitely, I would like to read the other books in the series.
Do you mean in the same way, meaning, you know, them at 16?
Or at whatever other point was formative to them, yeah.
Jar Jar Binks.
Absolutely, no. Yeah.
Why not? Why not?
A whole book in that dialogue, I would be delightful. Yeah,
him just governing whatever he governed in one of those movies.
That would be a literary book, though. complex language
of what are these people called? Gungans. Yeah, yes.
Man,
yeah,
that would Gungans. Make the hummingbird of Kathmandu look like nothing.
Holdo. I would love to see a book about Holdo.
Oh, wasn't Holdo such a great character?
Yeah.
You know, I have to admit that I was so blur that it took me like a few chapters and the point where they mentioned, because she keeps changing her hair color.
Mm.
And when they mentioned purple hair, and that was the, because they keep calling her Amelin and then Amelin Holdo.
Yeah.
Right? So purple hair, Holdo, then I'm like, oh my God, this is Laura Dern's younger version from Last of the Jedi. And I'm like, oh, now I know who she is.
Yeah.
We are the spark that will light the fire that will restore the Republic. That spark, this resistance must survive. That is our mission. Now to your stations. And may the Force be with us.
That's Admiral Holdo? Not what I expected.
It was very cool because I didn't realize that this book came out before the movie, which means if you had read the book before the movie came out, which you did, right, Arvind?
No, but the people who are listening, like some podcasters I listened to, they did. And they said that the book helped them understand Holdo's actions in the movie.
Mm. Which I think would have been very cool because that was the first time we were introduced to that character.
I agree. I mean, she has such a big moment, right? Like, she has such a big moment to play. And having this background of how their friendship grew and of what she is, because she is weird, you know, and she's weird and wonderful and wise, and just having all those things summed up in a teenager who would otherwise be kind of pushed to the periphery. And yet in this story, she is in many ways centralized, mostly because she keeps showing up. You know, it was really wonderful. And the minute she showed up on the page, I was like, hey, Flyboy.
Yeah,
it's Amelin Holdo. Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right, so we would like to hear Jar Jar Binks, sure.
Mm-hmm. Apparently.
Yes, Amelin Holdo.
I would like a Luke, you know.
I would like a Luke,
I think,
too.
Luke is overlooked because we feel like we met him when he was so young and we know so much about him already. But we don't really know anything about him before that.
It would be nice also because the scale is different, simply because he's a farm boy.
Yes.
So how that takes place would be interesting because here we get to swan through the palace of Alderaan. We get to watch Leia get dressed by her droid.
Tuvi.
I was obsessed with appearance. And we get to get all that glam. And it would be really interesting to... I think Luke's story would be so different because it wouldn't have the trappings of royalty. It wouldn't have the trappings of princess. So the form that story takes would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And how he learns he's like force sensitive and stuff. If he ever learns, like when he's on Tatooine. So that would be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and his temper is hot. So that would be kind of a fun thing to play with.
Yeah.
Speaking of hot tempers, I also love that they didn't like foreshadow Kylo Ren and stuff in this book. Like, I wonder who my son will be or something. That would have been bad. So I'm so glad they didn't touch on Vader and they didn't touch on Kylo.
I think anything that is remotely clunky in the book is a form of genre more than anything else.
Yes.
So it is to its credit that it doesn't do any of that stuff. Of even the moment where her hair gets twisted into side buns, not a thing. You know, it's just hair get twisted into side buns. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Not like someday this will... You know, just
people shall remember me for my side buns.
Exactly. She wears white a lot. And again, not a thing. It's just something that she does. So, yeah.
It's a wink more than a nudge.
Mm.
It's a wink more than a hard nudge.
It's a wink more than a throw it at your face.
Throw it at your face. Like, throw the book at your face. Like, Darth Vader!
I think you're right, Lynn, that whatever that I felt were the shortcomings of the book, the romance with Keir Domadi and some of the sort of breathy descriptions of what that feels like, I have to be honest, when I was 16 reading those books, I loved them.
Me too. Exactly.
So I, you know, looking at them now, maybe it's a sort of slight embarrassment and I'm like, oh, okay, that's where we are. But I feel like when you're in the genre, it's fine. Embrace it. That's a huge part of what it's like to be 16.
But also Star Wars is a YA movie. Like, I know a lot of adults like to go like, oh, it's an adult film. But it's not. It's a young adult.
You're going to attract a lot of vitriol for that.
I'm not on Twitter much. I don't care. So.
Let the blank slate live. You know, it's like we need to enjoy this while we can.
No, but you know how people like take Star Wars too seriously? It's not. It's either kids or it's a young adult film. It's about young adult romance. romance and young adult people finding themselves and coming of age, and it's completely fine. So it makes sense that they would write YA for a YA film.
You see, you actually answered a question that I've been meaning to ask from the beginning of the show, which is, why do you think they decided to do that as a YA book? Why not write a 16-year-old Leia? You know, from a marketing perspective, from everything, in fact, it would have just made more sense to sell it as a Leia book.
Man, I loved that it was YA, though.
I mean, do, too.
We've been complaining a little bit gently about the tropes, but the fact is that there is something about living Leia as a 16-year-old with all her impulses, with all her tears that she has to hold back from time to time, with all her temper. There's something about that that's very intoxicating and that you would not get from a more serious-minded, and someday she shall be queen.
Yes.
You know, kind of approach. This was very, like, you could have been Leia too. It's the Spider-Man approach
to
Star Wars.
Approach. Yeah. Yeah. And but also for a YA novel, I mean, I'm not saying that in a bad way, but if we're going to look at YA novels in a certain way, it has this air of, like, tragedy that's always there. Like, everything's
absolutely
tragic.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Even if you think about who her son's going to be, who she finds out her father's going to who she's going to meet, what happens to him in the long run, what happens to her son in the long run. Everything has, like, an air. Everything's tragic about Leia. But in this moment, in this book, everything's really, it sort of shows you why she is the way she is and why she was able to sort of withstand all those things in her life.
I know what you're going to say. I changed my hair.
It's nice that way. Leia, I'm sorry.
I know. I know you are. I'm just glad you're here. At the end.
I came to face him, Leia. And I can't save him.
I held out hope for so long, but I know my son's gone.
No one's ever really gone.
I think that's a perfect note to end on. Arvind, thank you so much for dropping by.
I'll bring the hummingbird of Kathmandu next.
No, please bring Luke, the farmer.
Yes,
of...
bring that book. You know.
I'll bring that book,
what's
yeah.
his planet? Okay, anyway.
Farm boy of Tatooine.
I'll always be here to talk about Star Wars.
And let us know what you think as well. Are you keen now on reading Leia, Princess of Alderaan? Are you keen on reading the other Star Wars books? Again, WhatsApp us, 018-789-8899. Or better yet, write us. We are at buythebook@bfm.my. We come to footnotes. Of course, since we've been talking about the Organas, and we just briefly touched on the fact that, of course, Princess Leia has two loving, if somewhat absent parents, absent for reasons, which we find out in the book, but Bail and Breha Organa. And then because Father's Day just passed over the weekend, we thought, why not talk about our favorite dads in literature? And while I continue to tussle over my choices of a rather rich list, we will instead kick things off with Arvind.
Yeah, Ned Stark. Ned Stark's my pick. I would go straight to Ned Stark from
you
Game of Thrones.
You stole mine, but okay.
Simply because I think he's the best dad in the entire series, or that, you know,
okay,
in all the books.
Low bar though, firstly.
Low bar. But it comes to show you can even like look at it as what happens when you have like good parents versus what happens when you have bad parents on the show. And the Lannisters have terrible parents.
Tywin's a terrible dad.
Yeah, the Targaryens have really bad parents. And the Stark kids have like one good dad, and they turn out okay.
The Stark kids have a great mom also. I would plump for the Stark kids just having good parents. Although Ned's an interesting choice because in many ways, Ned and his particular brand of, you know, hard-nosed honor is kind of to blame for a lot of the events of the book. And it's something that he passes on to his kids as well. I mean, it's something I've said on, I think, this show, other shows. Anytime I talk about Ned Stark, I just point out the fact that a lot of what Jon Snow is very much to do with Ned, for better or for worse.
And also that, I mean, that's one, but Jon Snow wouldn't be alive if it was not for Ned Stark. So that's another way of looking at it, I think.
Yes.
I also think that, you know, most of the father figures on the show have sort of taught their kids to follow in all the wrong footsteps. Like, you have the Mad King, and of course you mentioned like Tywin. But Ned Stark's the only one who has been who has had somewhat of a proper moral compass in a really bad world. And you know, Westeros is like a bad, bad world. It's not like a place that you want to live in. So it's nice to see. I mean, it's nice to see that someone has an intact moral compass on the show or in a number of books like that. Even though I will say he's a bad husband. He's not a good husband. He's a good dad.
So I've always felt like Ned was a bad husband because he was so busy being a good everything else. That the thing that he let drop was his wife.
Yes.
I would agree with you that I do think that he's the best dad that he could be.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than best dad compared to every dad in the world.
Yeah.
In a difficult circumstance, I think he tried.
In a horrible world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's a good dad at the expense of many other things, like the expense of leadership and government and his own family.
and his kids liking him.
Yeah. His head.
Oh, God.
But, you know.
I feel like I'm going to say something unpopular, which is that I'm going to say that I think Tywin Lannister is not a terrible dad. He's a terrible dad to Tyrion, don't get me wrong. And so if we were going off of, he is one-third a truly awful dad and then two-thirds like a deeply supportive father to his twins. I'm not saying that he raised champions, all right? Like the Lannisters, I'm not standing here trying to wave the flag of, you know, the lions, but it is worth saying that Tywin has a strong vision for his family, and part of that is providing for his children. And I just want to say that that is, I suppose, one aspect of being a father. We talk about, you know, trying to raise your kids right. We talk about the sensitivity. We talk about trying to be there in an emotional way for your children. And that's, of course, you know, really, really important parts of fatherhood. But Tywin does the other thing where he tries to provide. He tries to ensure that you have a legacy. He tries to ensure that my daughter is going to go down in history and my son is going to be, you know, my son is going to be leader of the King's Guard. You know, they're just all these things. I'm not saying he's right. Just if we're
as a dad.
As a dad, you know, if that's the parameter that we're going with, then I just wanted to
he
say
works.
not as bad as one might think. Mm. Yeah.
Well, speaking of complicated fathers, I think my pick for literary dad that I often think of would actually be Don Corleone from The Godfather. Again, I think not dissimilar maybe from a Tywin Lannister.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but with a lot more, I think overall the book itself positions him as a very good person. A good person who perhaps uses means that are not so good.
He has the same odds as Tywin actually. 3 kids and then 1 makes good.
Yeah, oh, that's true.
It's weird that all the dads in literature have some kind of conflict that makes them sacrifice something else in order to be good, you know?
Yes.
Like even the picks that we had,
yeah,
like Ned Stark and Dawn and even Tywin, have weird conflicts in a way that they have to sacrifice something big or like, you know, it's either it's family or doing
the right thing. Because men are never positioned as the family being their sole responsibility, right? Hmm. So in books, they are often juggling honor, family, livelihood, you know, their ambitions. And so it almost feels like one has to drop for them to be good at. There are very few characters that are good at everything.
Yeah.
And in the case of Don Corleone in particular, because it is an entire dynasty, it's very similar to Tywin, actually, because it's an entire dynasty that he has to look after. Because, like you said, he has employed means throughout his career to get to where he's going. I think the main thing about him is that his understanding of family cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. There is the family, as in the mob, and then there is the family, which is his actual blood. And I think the main thing about him that makes him a great dad is the fact that he actually knows his sons, or he tries to know his sons very deeply.
Yeah, and I think the fact that, you know, all the things that he's done in the books, which is to let Sonny sort of walk in his footsteps, let Michael be the good one, these are all from a deep familiarity with his children, to know what their limits are, what their capabilities are. And he doesn't he doesn't expect them to be molded in his form, which I think is a big thing for a dad, because typically fathers see kids as an extension of themselves.
Parents do, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But and fathers often have the means to make that happen in a way that's a lot more, I think, visible, especially boys and fathers. And I think that Don Corleone, for all that he's the head of this, you know, mob family, he has been someone, I think, who had tried to give his kids something more than he could have been, or something different from what he could have been.
My pick is going to be quite different, I think, than the relatively alpha dude picks that have come about, because I'm going to go for Arthur Weasley.
Oh, I love Arthur Weasley.
I went back and forth on, you know, whether or not I wanted to go with a complicated dad or, you know, just a straightforwardly great dad. And since you guys cornered the market on complicated, Arthur, who is not your classic male character in that he is not driven by his career necessarily. In fact, in the books, he's picked what is probably the worst outpost of the ministry to kind of try and do his work, muggles. He is somebody who is busy. He's like a careerist, but there for the greater good. And through it all, just a really great, attentive dad, and somebody who also manages to be that for Harry Potter, you know, and for Hermione in many ways, not just to his brood of Weasley kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He reminds me of the dad in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. You know what I mean? It's like he's good at what he does.
Yeah.
And he also has his like bumblingness and stuff, mm-hmm. but he's a dad.
Mm. He is. And they're actually relatively few sweet dads that come to mind when you think of dads in books.
Who then actually have a major role in said book, I think. So there are sweet dads, but they sort of potter around.
They're in the background.
Give you a cup of tea, walk back out, you know. Whereas Arthur is involved when there is a car that crashes into a tree. Whose car is it? It is Arthur Weasley's, you know. He's in the stories. Yeah. And for that reason, you know, just happy Father's Day, Arthur Weasley, because you are a great book dad. And I guess that sums it up from us. But of course, feel free to weigh in, because we would like to know what your favorite literary dads are. Do you agree with the choices of Ned Stark, half of Tywin Lannister, Don Corleone, as well as Arthur Weasley? Do you have your own favorite book dad? WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us as well at BFM Radio. And of course, write us. Write us about anything at all at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.